Another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have David Wim Hof back on the show. He returns to discuss an article he wrote earlier in the month, Who is an American? It used to be a simple question. It's become much more difficult because maybe this another question is, what was America? What is America? What will become of America? Let me do this. Why did that pop up? David is a lawyer practicing in South Bend, Indiana, and the author of the very important John Courtney Murray, Time, Life, and the American Proposition, How the CIA's Doctrinal Warfare Changed the Catholic Church. His website is The American Proposition. That book, I understand, is going under another revision. I've said this before, and I'll say it again. It's probably one of the most informative and important books that I've read, personally, I think, because it explains so much about not only the world I grew up in, and the world, of course, my children are being delivered into or living in, but the, sort of how society changed. And there's so much information that, that so many people aren't simply aware of, how their life, they were a product of social engineering and psychological warfare. So I want to thank you for writing that book, and I look forward to the revision.
Well, thank you very much, Tim. Thank you for having me on. Thank you for the work that you are doing. I think it is very important. I think that you're getting great rewards in heaven.
Well, I'll pray on that. I hope.
Okay.
I try. Well, thank you. Well, listen, whoever goes first, we'll help each other out. How's that?
That sounds like a good plan. That's a very good plan.
Well, I know my wife's praying for me, so.
Well, that's good. That's very good.
okay, good. Well, who is an American? Well, you wrote this arc earlier in the month. So let's get into it. Who is an American? What is an American?
I'm an American. You're an American.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We're both Christian. We're both of European descent. We're born in this country. We speak English, and we've got the American heritage. We accept it. We're here because there's a whole line of people that were born and decided to come here and work here and build what was here. And you have to take a look at America as being consisting of various peoples. There's no doubt about that. There are various peoples. There is Americans who I say are of European descent, meaning white people. I mean, everybody knows a white person is of European descent. I mean, the Europeans and the English came up with that concept. The founders implemented it in the 1790 Naturalization Act and the 1795 Naturalization Act. They knew what it meant. They also knew, even Thomas Paine knew what it meant. And they knew that whites or Europeans are different from Negroes or blacks. Then they were called Negroes, mm-hmm. or Africans. So, you know, you got the American people in this country. You got the Negro people in this country. You've got the Latin people in this country. You know, you got some Orientals. You got Japanese, Chinese, and various other Orientals. And what has become very clear, if we didn't know it by now, is you got the Jewish people in this country. So you got multiple nations, and the whole idea of Jews being a separate ethnicity should be very clear after all of the trouble on the campuses, after all the riots on the campuses.
I haven't noticed.
Yeah. Well, I'm here to tell you, you know, Bill Ackman making it very clear.
Yes.
He made it very clear. White people aren't Jews and Jews aren't white people. And the same thing, you may have seen that old clip with Morgan Freeman and Dan Wallace, you know, and Dan Wallace says,
there was a
I'm
Mike
not a white
Wallace?
guy. Or Mike Wallace. Mike
Yeah,
Wallace, you're right.
Yeah, yeah.
Mike Wallace says, I'm not a white guy, I'm a Jew. Okay, good. So now we know white people are American. So I'm going to say American white people. I'm an American. That's the term I use.
Well, that distinction means that they what they identify as white, which is sort of a deracinated European ethnic white, right? Right. And that's
well,
a Christian.
Well,
I mean, if
well,
Jews distinguish themselves from whites, what the distinguishing factor is Christianity, or at least their descendants were Christians, genuine Christians, right? Would that be
that is? I think that is a factor. I think that's definitely a factor. I mean, we're talking about in the United States, we're talking about people that believe in Christ and the Ten Commandments, okay, that are of European descent. So that it distinguishes us from Jews. If we're of European descent, we're not Negroes. Okay, we speak English. We're born on this land, on this dirt. It's very important because this dirt makes multiple peoples come into existence, like the Negroes and other peoples. Now, the Jews are irredentists. They kind of travel around until they got Israel, and maybe they're going to be leaving that soon. But in any event, you know, there you have different peoples that form in this environment, on this territory, with the challenges that they face. You know, this country was settled and built by Americans. I mean, and white people, okay? It was English, Scotsmen, a few Irish, a lot of Germans, and Northern Europeans generally.
Yeah.
This is the ethnic stock of the American people. And
this is a pioneer versus immigrant, right? You would say kind of like.
Well, yes, this is pioneer versus immigrant, but also too, this culture, this society was able to absorb immigrants, and it did absorb immigrants. They were able to assimilate. Now the Catholics were harder to assimilate, but the Northern Europeans, especially the Protestants, easily assimilated, but the Catholics did assimilate. And then the Jews were very hard to assimilate. And I believe it was James Truslow Adams or Andre Siegfried writing about 100 years ago. And he said, you know, the Jews don't really quite assimilate. He said, you know, they just don't. But they're a different nation. They're a different people. And then, of course, you know, you got the Negroes or the blacks, and they don't assimilate. They it's very difficult, almost impossible in many cases for them to assimilate. So what you have is you have different nations. You have different peoples. And this is a definition. This is an idea. The idea of nations or peoples existing as part of the polity is something that's been lost. Okay, this idea was lost beginning with Grotius in 1604, who, by the way, wrote about freedom of the seas, about the same area that the Chinese are claiming exclusive control of the seas. So, you know, history repeats itself, doesn't it? Freedom of the seas, what he wrote about. So Grotius started this idea of a polity, and he didn't have this idea of different ethnicities or groups within it. Locke picked it up. He put his own individualism with it, along with the Dutch and English upper classes. But then, you know, the Catholics had always recognized this idea of nations or ethnicities. And this idea came back in a big way in 1935, when John Epstein wrote his book, The Catholic Understanding of the Law of Nations. I think we talked about this once before. And what he said, you know, he said, it's in my article, he said, hey, guess what? There's an American people. There's an American nation. And they come from all over Europe, and that's who they are. And they have certain rights, and they have certain duties. And part of those rights is to have a culture and to be protected, and basically to look after the family so that the person can be properly developed. So you have to nurture this group of people. You have to provide them the fundamental rights, the basic things. So you have to allow them to have kids, encourage them to have kids, have a real culture, worship God, grow prosperous, be protected. This is basic stuff. St. Thomas Aquinas from the Summa Theologica, I think it's what? Part two of part one, question 95. This is the whole Ius Gentium, okay? This is what he's talking about. This was an idea that was lost until I argue, was recovered in 1935 by John Epstein. Now, the same time Epstein was doing that, the elites in America were saying, "Ruh-roh, we got a problem here," because you know what? We got this American people, this American identity that's really strong, and we want to basically control things, and we don't want to grow the economic pie. So then they started talking about interracial justice, and they boiled everything down to skin color. Now, race is a component of nationhood. That is something that everybody agrees. It's race, it's culture, it's identity, it's traditions, it's all of this stuff. But what the elites did is they said, it's all about skin color, it's all about race, parts are parts, pieces of pieces, you're all the same. Well, that's ridiculous. They weren't interested in developing peoples. I mean, they talked that way for a little bit, but Gunnar Myrdal said, we're going to re-engineer American society. Those aren't his exact words, but he said, this is going to be a reworking of American society.
Gunnar
and he said that.
Yeah, Gunnar Myrdal or Myrdal was Swedish. He wrote the book, The American Dilemma. At least it was written under his name in 1940. And I think he was working with the University of Chicago. And he's the one that came up with the idea. Basically, he said that America was irredeemably racist and it would require things like judicial activism, bureaucratic fiat to resolve America's racial issues, right? And I think that was...
That is absolutely correct. Yeah. And in the Catholic arena, you had Father John Lafarge, and he was carrying the torch of interracial justice at the same time. And he was a Jesuit, of course. Mm-hmm. And he met Pope Pius XI in June of 1938. And according to Lafarge's autobiography, Pope Pius XI said, "I like that term. I've never heard it before, interracial justice." Well, of course you haven't heard it before, because we had the Law of Nations.
Yes.
Because we had Ius Gentium. We had peoples. We had nations. We had that whole idea that rightly orders the relation between the person, and then the nation, the extended family, the state, and international community.
Yeah, it sounds like one of those woolly, nice ideas, but no one really clearly defines and nor thinks of nor the long-term implications of its implementation, meaning given all the complexities and other considerations that we have when you have so many people like inhabiting the planet and different cultures. Even the United States was at that time was very regional. You had the Midwest, the South, the East, the West Coast, the East Coast, different values and all that stuff. So that to the extent even then in the 1930s, America was still decentralized. It tended to work better because localism, that's of course, you know, subsidiarity is also a Catholic principle. How do you reconcile a woolly notion like interracial justice or racial justice with subsidiarity?
Well, you can't. You're putting people at odds with each other.
Yeah.
And you're putting people at odds with each other so that they don't notice who's calling the shots at the top, because they only have so big of a pie.
Are you saying you're saying the elites have an ulterior motive here?
Huh. I never thought of that. Yes, there is an ulterior motive. So all throughout our lives, we have been under attack. Okay. We have been denied our identity as Americans. I mean, American has come to mean a U.S. citizen. Okay, that's fair. But there are different, that's a legal status. There are different peoples. There are different groups of peoples. And when I say, you know, American, Negro, well, I don't know. I think there's, and even Jew, and Latin and so on. I mean, there are subgroups, okay, of all these. It's not monolithic, but there are subgroups. And like you said, you know, there's some local flavor, some regional flavor. Okay, so, but there are these identities. And this identity of being an American, especially a white rural American, as we are being called by the elites, and that I discuss in my article, white rural America, we're the enemy. In other words, the American is the existential threat to America. That's where we are now. And when they describe American in these books that just came out by Barbara Walter, not Walters, Walter, and what's his name, Schaller and Waldman, called White Rural Rage. Say that five times.
Yeah,
White Rural Rage. Okay. That book just came out. And these guys are saying that the rural white is the problem. Why? And they say it very clearly, because they're community and they're God-based and they're patriotic.
Well, we're the problem, whether I'm, I don't, I guess I, they probably would consider me a white rural American, is where it's our nation. So how are we a problem? It's our nation.
Well, they're trying to remake us. They're trying to remake a new people. And our people are pretty strong and powerful people. And we have a lot of good characteristic traits about us. We're optimistic. We're can do. You know, can is an American.
Well, that's why we're the problem.
That's why we're the problem. They want a submissive people that they can control. They want a new people that they want to create. They are redefining what it means to be an American. And that discussion is in the movie Civil War, which is a very dark movie, which I saw. I if you haven't seen it, it's extremely dark. Just get ready to be really depressed after you see it.
Is it agitprop?
It might be agitprop. Somebody says it's a cautionary tale. Was that a warning or a threat during an election year? But
because the system does this from time to time. Obviously, before motion pictures, you had Uncle Tom's Cabin, which is agitprop, right? And then you have, of course, I think you mentioned the article, the movie Pearl Harbor, which came out, I think, in the summer of 2001, of the late spring, as opposed to the December of that year, which would have been the 60th anniversary of that assault. But nevertheless, they rushed it out for the summer, which sort of got everyone. Yeah. At the same time, also you had Band of Brothers. It premiered September 9th, 2001.
Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know that's when that came out. I knew Pearl Harbor came out over Memorial Day weekend. So is this motion picture? It's obviously preparing people for something.
And you had the Project for New American Century calling for a new Pearl Harbor, a catalyzing catastrophic event to energize the American people for a global, crusade. So,
there is a real division in America now. What I think this movie stands for is ethnic warfare being unleashed by the owners if you elect the wrong guy president. Okay.
Well, we got a taste of that in 2020, didn't we?
Apparently we elected the right guy president. but if you choose wrong this time, there's got to be a problem. And it's ethnic warfare, because people say, well, how can California and Texas be allied? Well, because in both of those states, whites are not Americans, are not the majority. In California, 35%, in Texas, about 42%. Mm-hmm. So that's why you have the alliance. And so the president in that motion picture, he shoots the press. that's one thing he does. He shoots the press. He took another term of office. He disbanded the FBI. So what they're saying is this guy's a strong leader. And the liberal order does not like strong leaders. They don't like, that's why George Soros in August 2021 said Xi Jinping has to go, because he's a strong leader. Well, you're not only dealing with a strong leader here, George, but you're also dealing with a culture and with a political party that's very nationalistic, but it uses communism or Marxism to project as a weapon. And in America, there was very similar in some ways. Now, let me explain that. There's always been two Americas, as I believe and as I put forth in some of the things I've written. I think there is the local, the grassroots America. These are the Americans seeking the truth. This is the community, the God-fearing, white rural Americans, America. These are the guys who are cooperating with God in creation. And all of the historians, James Truslow Adams and others from the last century, they all talked about that, because it's really pretty plain. We had to build this country because it was wilderness. It was nothing. And we turned it into something very, very productive, able to feed and fuel the world, at the same time come up with incredible advances in science, medical technology, space technology, all over. We were able to really expand creativeness and improve life in many ways. That's one part of America. That's the natural law. We want to follow the natural law type thing. We're on the local level. We're dealing with this frontier. And then you got the upper level, where you got all these different groups of people here. We're all alone. We got to really face some pretty daunting odds, and we got to make everybody work together. Okay. And so that's where this whole idea of liberalism came in. I mean, it had some practical aspects to it in 1787, when they did the Constitution. It had some practical aspects to keep people together and working. But federalism was there to make sure that that ideology stayed up at the top. Okay, well, federalism got swept away effectively with the 14th Amendment after the Civil War, and then with all of the decisions beginning with Gitlow in 1925 that pushed this ideology down to the local area. Now, I'm a lawyer, okay? You know, I'm a lawyer. So I talk from a lawyer's point of view as I take a look at this. I mean, I can't talk about it from other points of view, really, but this is as a lawyer, I'm looking at it. I'm saying this is how it worked.
And is Gitlow the incorporation doctrine?
Gitlow was the incorporation doctrine. That came out in 1925.
Rights, the Bill of Rights unto them was presumed only applied to the federal government. Gitlow applies it to the states. And that's judicial.
Correct.
That's not an amendment. It's judicial fiat. It's a UK ruling.
It's a judicial decision that came in 1925.
Yeah.
Why is that date significant? Because in 1924, okay, in 1924, the Ku Klux Klan was at its height. And who was the Ku Klux Klan? I know, as Catholics, we're supposed to, oh, they were terrible. They were going to hang us, blah, 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 blah. Well, a lot of people have a different view of the Klan, okay? And I just want to read you something from, I think I've got it here. I don't know what happened to it now. My office is a mess. Here's something from the Klan headquarters. And a lot of people say this is legit. It says, we are here to cultivate and promote a real patriotism toward our civil government, exemplify our practical benevolence, shield the sanctity of home and the chastity of womanhood, and by a practical devotion, conserve and maintain the distinct institutions, rights and privileges, principles, traditions, and ideals of pure Americanism. And a quote. Now they weren't talking about Americanism like Leo XIII was, because these were Americans, okay? These guys were mostly Protestant, European descent, rural and middle class, and I think there's a pretty good case to be made that this was pretty much of an ethnic movement, and it was pretty strong, and it was grassroots. And I think the powers in this country started to understand we might have a problem, because the economic elites about 10, 15 years earlier were planning for world dominion. I mean, I think we all agree on that. They were starting to plan with the Federal Reserve and other things. They're going to push out, you know, women's rights, women's voting rights. That was a dead letter by 1910 until the Belmonts picked it up and the Astors and so on and so forth. And then they ran with this thing. And the Belmonts pushed this thing around the world. And they tried to push it down to Latin America. And Latin America, this is in the late 1920s, early 1930s, they said, get out of here. We're not interested in this. Well, that was the first attack. Ultimately, you know, they succumbed. But this is what was going on. And so I think this is very significant, because the Klan affected the immigration laws and the political structure in this country to make it, some say, lily white. I say to make it American. In May of 1924, President Coolidge clearly said, as he signed the Immigration Act that was in place from 1924 to 1965, and we can talk about that in a minute, that Immigration Act, he said, we have to keep America American. And this would actually make sure that people from Northern Europe came in more than from other parts of Europe. But it also, too, allowed a lot of people from Latin America to come in, but they just weren't coming in great numbers.
Yeah.
But that all changed, of course, in 1965 with the Hart-Celler Act. And the Hart-Celler Act was...
Immigration is one of these things where people think that it's like Emma Lazarus's poem is written in the Constitution, and she was just a radical, you know, a Jewish poet, probably a communist. But the whole idea of giving us your poor, tired, you know, hungry, yearning to be free, all that, that's not in the Constitution, nor is it desirable. Immigration is always a question of who, how many, and when. And it's perfectly reasonable for a government to change policies based on the circumstances of the time. And you could say that 1924, America had absorbed a huge amount of immigrants, particularly from Southern and Eastern Europe at the time. There were problems, but they like you said, ultimately they proved to be assimilable, and they worked. It worked out okay.
That's right.
That doesn't mean everybody should be able to get into the country from all regions of the world. I mean, that's ridiculous. But
that's right.
It was pathologized 40 years later. Of course, they lied in 1965 when they signed the Hart-Celler Act. When Lyndon Johnson signed it, all the politicians said this law will not change the country's demographics, which suggests that they at least they gave lip service to the concern that if you change the country's demographics, you're going to change the country's culture and politics, and you're going to disintegrate the nation. So it does matter of who's coming into the country and what culture is.
Yes,
taking.
It does. It does matter who comes into the country and the culture. And it is moral, like you said, to restrict immigration. It is absolutely moral. You are not supposed to morally allow unlimited numbers of people come in. You're not supposed to allow people in to create fusion or suppression of one group. And that's what's going on in this country now. They are demoralizing us. We'll talk about that in a minute. They are trying to erase us as Americans. And that's been going on for a long time with the statues going down and with huge influxes of people from different cultures. This is going to create instability. And this is being top-down driven. Okay.
Yes.
Now let's talk about Hart-Celler Act, okay? Let's talk about that. That was a Catholic Jewish enterprise, okay? And let's talk about something else. John F. Kennedy, you heard that phrase, a nation of immigrants. Have we talked about that before?
Well, he was commissioned to write the book, but he did it for B'nai B'rith, right? He was hired by B'nai B'rith.
Yeah, he did it for the ADL. That's right.
Yeah.
He did it for the ADL. And if you go back a little further, what I found in Georgetown back in 1953, there was a meeting of Catholics, the Catholic Association of International Peace, and one of the Jesuits got up and said, you know what? We can pack a lot of people into America from the third world. So, you know, what's going on here? The worst fears of the Klan are getting played out here. You're starting to see a Catholic-Jewish alliance to bring in all sorts of people into this country. And right now the president's a Catholic, and you also have a very heavily Jewish controlled administration. So a lot of their fears are coming to pass. But what you have to realize is immigration has got to be there for the purpose of, you know, keeping the country stable. You can't just let everybody in. School of Salamanca knew that. You are absolutely correct. So, what's been going on in this country? I mean, you know, you create disorder with improper immigration. This comes from the top down. Nothing happens in America without the socioeconomic elites. And they're all types. I call them the plutocratic class. You got, if you look at religion, you got Catholics, Protestants, Jews, you've got Americans, you got Jews, you got a couple Asian Indians, maybe a couple Latinos. But that's kind of your elite. That's your elite that are doing this. The people who put out this movie, Civil War, A24 Studios, the guy, what's his name? Garland. He's Lebanese. He's Lebanese English. A24 is a studio. And one of the founders of that studio, Katz is his name. I think it's Daniel Katz. He came from Guggenheim, International Investors and Consultants. Well, I mean, you know, you look at Guggenheim. I mean, it's Americans and Jews. Okay, so this is the economic financial elites who are doing this and who have been demoralizing us for years. And they've been demoralizing us for years with the crap that came out of Hollywood. You know, the Western is a prime example. Okay, throughout the 1960s, till about 1969, Hollywood was making Westerns. Those are great movies. That was the American identity. John Wayne is the American. He's my hero. I grew up with him. A lot of people did. You know, he is our hero. He is the example of a guy. He's honest. He's hardworking. He's always the good guy. He's plain spoken, you know, pretty simple, great heart, and tough, you know, and that's American. That is the essence of the American character. Well, that all changed with the spaghetti Westerns. And, you know, they get kind of ambivalent in there. And then Midnight Cowboy. And then it all changes with these movies. What was it? Dances with Wolves, where we were the bad guys in the Western. You know, we're the bad guys. And then after, what was the other one? There was another Western that came out shortly after that. Unforgiven, which showed the lawman as the bad guy. Well, the lawman was always the good guy. Because what Americans have always done is we have practiced that principle of the natural law of providential destination. We developed this land. We put it to use. We cooperated with God in making this land profitable. Now, it's the people at the higher levels who live by a different rule, who have this ideology that is outward looking. Those people may have controlled the fruits of our labor and in the process made things bad for people around the world and given us a bad name. And that's what we have to watch out for, because we're under attack, not only inside from the elites who are constantly demoralizing us, constantly demonizing us, but we're under attack by people who we think are also our friends. I told somebody the other day, I said, you got a number of solvents going on. I said, I saw this years ago in a place far away. I saw how radical Islam was used to dissolve the ethnic identity of the people. Okay, well, you know what? Religion in this country can be used to do it too. Whether that religion is Protestantism or Catholicism, if it is not tied to the people and their traditions and their nation and their history and their identity, then you're erasing them. And I've seen this with a lot of chatters. Another way that there is a solvent being used is the whole racialist thing. Well, we're white, you know. Well, no, you're an American. You got a tradition. Race, DNA is a component of that, okay? And then another way you see it is political. Well, it's all conservative, liberal, and that's all just made up stuff. But what's really interesting, what I've said about the elites controlling this society is something that Charles Murray has noticed and something that Patrick Deneen has noted. And they both said that the elites live a different life than the rest of the people and that the rest of us are being demoralized and we're being destroyed.
Wasn't it F. Scott Fitzgerald that said the rich aren't different, they have more money?
Yeah, I think you're right.
And it simplifies it because they have so much money that they can sort of remove themselves from the everyday concerns, anxieties, things that keep you balanced. Even like you said, rooted something close enough to nature that you know there is a natural law, there's reality to these things. That's why you get some of this transhumanist nonsense, like the new World Economic Forum dreams about technocracy and these things that they can actually indulge these fantasies of being uploaded to the mothership or something. And
right. No, yeah. You're absolutely right. And you know there's a lot of strands of ideologies that fuel into this. I mean, you can say, you know, in a way, Calvinism fuels this because it says, you know, you got to work and be prosperous. And if you're prosperous, you know, you're elect. And, you know, the Puritan idea of hard work. I mean, you can say all that stuff kind of figures into it, you know, but these values of hard work and responsibility and cooperation and honesty, I mean, these characterize us as people. How these things are misused is a separate thing. These things are misused by the elites who don't have any loyalty to us. And a guy who pointed that out about 20 years ago, this month, I think it was the late Samuel Huntington. And he said in his article, Dead Souls, the Denationalization of the American Elite, he said, the public overall is concerned with physical security, but also with societal security, which involves a sustainability within acceptable conditions for evolution of existing patterns of language, culture, association, religion, and national identity. For many elites, these concerns are secondary to participating in the global economy, supporting international trade and migration, strengthening international institutions, promoting American values abroad, aka liberalism, and encouraging minority identities and cultures at home. I mean, he got it in 2004.
Yeah,
that's right. And so the elites are at war with us. I've said this before. The elites are at war with us. And Patrick Deneen says this. And I think Charles Murray sees this. And so they don't have the loyalty to us, which should give us a lot of concern, quite frankly, because we're in a dangerous spot right now in the world. Everybody's eyes are on Gaza and Ukraine. And I am not diminishing any of the horrors or any of the bad that may be associated with those places. I'm just saying, everybody's watching that. But over here in the South China Sea is where I think, and other people think, the real danger is. Because right now, you've got two countries, Russia and China, working together. One is the manufacturing capital of the world, that's China. The other one has a vast amount of natural resources, and they're fueling it as best they can to China. They've got some transportation issues they're working on and capacity issues, but they're fueling it to them and they're helping each other in various ways. So what I'm saying is that,
Who built China's industrial capacity?
well, I think that that was probably a lot of help from the West
You think
with,
about that. Yeah.
we built it. But this brings us, to the next issue. It's like China, from a number of different sources, is building up for war. As we sit here today, there's an article in, I think, the Bangkok Times that says China is stockpiling 10 essential raw materials as we speak. And it's a huge acceleration of stockpiling. So while we're all watching one side, China could make a strike that would endanger US leadership, if not hegemony, in the world, and also seize Taiwan, where they're making chips, and cause a lot of problems. But here's the thing, too, about China. You brought up a very good point, as you always do. And the good point is, American industry built China. Okay. And the guys went over there with our businesses when we built them up, and our guys made profits. And the Chinese allowed them to make profits, and they imposed increasingly harsher conditions on doing business in China, but the profits were so good. And part of those conditions were you had to have a Chinese company. Part of it was, we're going to steal your intellectual property. But part of it is, you got to hand all your stuff over. You can't leave with it. Tesla just made a deal with Baidu. It just came through today where, yeah, you can work with us on this mapping technology, but it's got to all stay here. So this is an example of how China is, as Khrushchev said, buying the rope from us that they'll hang us with. Years ago, Khrushchev said, as you probably recall, he said, "We're going to buy the rope from you capitalists, and we're going to hang you with your own rope." Well, I think China looks like they're doing that now. And so it's very dangerous at this point in history to be attacking your base ethnic population, which is the American, the rural white, the American, the farmer. It's really a bad idea to be attacking us right now, but that's what the elites are doing, which causes you to ask a question: what are these guys doing? What are the elites up to? Are they up to a situation where, as Wallerstein says, a friend of mine, a priest friend of mine, referred me to his work, Emmanuel Wallerstein, is this world systems analysis view, where the world is just a big factory and marketplace, and the people who can manipulate the capital and the goods the best are just going to control the whole thing, and the states are just used to advance profits? Is that where we're going here? Because that does not take into account the best interests of nations or peoples, which means the best interests of families and of persons. And that reduces states or governments to little more than a puppet of some guy in a corporate boardroom. And that is not good for people. And we're starting to see that.
I mean, you look at Vanguard and BlackRock, you definitely start to see those contours, right? Or at least the power relationships.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and also if you idea of the sovereign governments that are going so far into debt and they're in hock, to the various central banks that print the money up that monetize the various government bonds to create all the credit and debt that funds all these wars. So you're thinking, I mean, this economic system is ridiculous, and at the same time, who do we owe the money to? I mean, look at the national debt. Who's that owed to? $34 trillion.
Well, 34, but well, 8 trillion, as I understand it, is owed to the Federal Reserve, about
Okay, so
26 trillion.
it's on their balance sheets. Okay,
It's on their
so
balance sheet, right?
who are our creditors, and it's a time for them to take a haircut.
Well, yeah, the 26 trillion, is foreign governments, and I'm sorry, I forgot the breakdown. I might have it handy,
Yeah.
but it's divided between foreign governments, big
China? Is
institutional,
it China?
Well, China has about $850 billion, but it is
Yeah.
decreasing. Actually, there are other countries. You can find it. You can pull it up and see who owns the debt.
Well, part of the deal with the American Empire was we have our gunboat diplomacy, and countries just buy up our debt. That's all part of the Henry Kissinger's deal in the 1970s with the petrodollar and idea, you could run this huge debt up and the world just absorb your inflation. but we have our military. And what was suggested, recently with events in Israel with the Iran supersonic missiles and the missile technology, is that the West, NATO, the United States, may be losing its hard power advantage. It definitely no longer has soft power, because everyone holds the United States and the West in contempt, deservedly so. So at the end of the day, it's a one big bluff, right?
Well, the United States military is still considered the strongest in mm-hmm. the world, but China is coming up to it. I've been looking at the numbers. Their Navy is probably bigger than ours. Their Air Force is at a parity. They have faster cruise missiles than us.
The leadership is smarter.
Well, they're determined. Yes. And they actually care about their people and the continuation of their people. Our leadership does not. I think we can say that very clearly. I mean, the political leadership and the socioeconomic leadership.
Joe Biden himself.
They care about the monetary aspect. Yes. They care about making money. Everything is monetized in America, and that is a great loss.
Well, this came out today. You know, they passed this $95 billion foreign aid package where the government's going to borrow more money to ship it abroad. And it turns out that Mike Johnson, the speaker, who helped shepherd this legislation through, in betrayal of his campaign promises or what he claimed he stood for when he was coming speaker, was a recipient of $500,000 from AIPAC. And of course, $26 billion of this foreign aid package went to Israel to continue its ethnic cleansing operation in Gaza.
Well, we're in a world war. I mean, we're in a world war. I said that 2 years ago when Russia went into Ukraine. I said the world war has started. And it's just expanded. Now, there are several theaters. There's, the European theater, the Middle Eastern theater, and East Asia or West Asia. Or it's East Asia, West Pacific. Mm-hmm. Hopefully people will realize that's actually a very real theater. And, every day there are incidences of Chinese vessels and planes confronting American and Filipino planes and vessels because they are exerting power. They've gone through a phase where they blunted us. They're building, and now they're expanding, according to some thinkers and some writers.
I thought neoliberalism was going to bring world peace because we're all trading together. What happened to that?
Well, that was a lie.
Okay.
That was a lie. And it enriches the pockets of some people who probably don't care whether we go to war or not. Secretary of Commerce, Raimondo, is that her name? Raimondo, she recently said something in an interview, and she looked genuinely sad. I mean, I think she realized what happened. She said, we cared more about the bottom line than national security. Yeah, that's right. Well, to believe in national security, you got to believe in your people. You got to believe in your country. You got to have a country. You got to believe in your nations. You got to believe you got something good and special. And America, I'm going to say, is still. And it did provide a good home for a lot of people. But the elites are betraying us. And that's a very real problem. But she understands the problem where you financialize everything and you hollow out your industries. Now, that having been said, the United States, with 4% of the population, manufactures 16% of the world's goods. I mean, we're punching four times above our weight. Now, I get it. It's not the heavy industry, okay? It's a lot of computer stuff and medical stuff and such like that. But we have to reindustrialize.
Yeah,
we've got to reindustrialize.
Well, there's
now
an argument.
Sure.
There's an argument for autarky because, well, the idea of free trade was you play off peoples or you take advantage of comparative advantages and absolute advantages,
right,
and all that.
Right.
Now, that all works great, presuming a perfect world. But when do you have a perfect world?
Well, you don't. And if you're going to have free trade, then you have to have an international authority to look over the private financial interests. Because those are the guys who are going to gain from trade. Trade has always been about finance. The American founders understood this.
Mm-hmm.
They knew it. Alexander Hamilton knew it. And so that's why they structured what they structured, because the U.S. was in a particularly good spot to capitalize on trade. This weekend, I was looking over Ben Franklin's notes, and in 1774, and he was talking, he was trying to work something out late December or early December 1774 with the British, saying, hey, you know, we really don't want to break away, we just want some changes. Well, one of the changes they wanted is, we want to control our own trade.
Yeah.
And we want to be able to manufacture goods. And hey, that's going to help us get currency, because the American colonies were being squeezed for currency. And I mean, couldn't manufacture anything. And then you couldn't go west either. And the Quebec Act kept you from going west. And everybody says, well, the Quebec Act, you know, it was there for the purpose of, you know, establishing a Catholic government in Quebec. Well, yeah, okay. But it also gave the fur trade to the Canadians. Okay. That's something a lot of people don't know. It gave the fur trade. Well, that was very lucrative. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so when you have trade, you have to have finance. And Americans, we're creative. Okay. We are creative at all levels. We are creative. We're innovative. And this is what you alluded to earlier. Are we losing our innovative edge? Well, Ray Dalio says, yeah, we're on our way to losing that. And innovation and creativity, if you lose that, you're second rate power. That's it.
Well, you don't maintain that edge or improve it by destroying your core population, which is white Americans.
Exactly. Well, and I'd say Americans.
We see that with the competency crisis, the obsession on diversity, and the there's obviously, if you look at this obsession with minority representation or overrepresentation, proportional representation, is just taking account of real differences in culture, in temperament, and in preferences, which have real material conditions, how a certain one group performs better than another. And it's just one of those things where if your presumption is everyone's equal, and if it's not, then there must be some sort of racist, you know, a conspiracy afoot. That's ridiculous, because groups are different. Groups are very different. In fact, groups will brag about their different. Jews will talk about their higher verbal IQ and higher intelligence, which is why they have disproportional representation. It has nothing to do with ethnic nepotism or scheming. It's because they're just smarter than everybody else. But when they say that, they're not called racist. But when you juxtapose, say, white performance or white representation in employment, higher income jobs, or these sort of things with blacks, it's not because whites perform better, it's because of racism.
And that is how you destroy national identity.
Yes.
Okay. We're a nation. You and I are part of an American nation. Now, maybe we're subgroups. Okay. I'm Midwestern, you're East Coast. Okay. Mm-hmm. I get it. Okay.
But, although my family does come from the Midwest. So.
Well, okay. Hey, you're one of us, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're my brother. I mean, seriously, I mean, we are a nation. We are a people, just like the Negroes or the blacks are a nation, just like the Jews are a nation. Mm-hmm. And they are a people. OK, and they and every and when you start saying, oh, it's about you're a racist if you do that, they're talking about skin color. OK, I mean, the term race has many meanings. Mm-hmm. Well, they mean race meaning skin color. OK, and once again, remember, these ideas don't get air unless they are allowed to get air by the elites, by the people at the top.
Well, someone owns the media.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, right. That's right. Who owned Time Life?
That's right. And somebody, Henry Luce. Yeah, right. That's right.
Who ran CBS News, right? I mean, it's like they're.
Paley.
Yeah, exactly. So Paley and like Sarnoff, you know, who owned the New York Times and these things? And so. Well, the
New York Times was actually Sulzberger's. They were Dutch. They were Dutchmen.
Yes, a lot of Dutchmen got into publishing and banking.
No, I mean they're really Dutch. They were
Dutch, but
no,
they,
I'm serious. They were Dutch Reformed, I think, and then I think they became Presbyterian.
Yeah,
I could be wrong about that, but they were Dutch Reformed at some point.
Well, I think maybe didn't they leave Spain at some point?
No. As far as I know, from the research I did, I mean that's what I found out. I mean, because there's still a lot of people of Dutch descent in New York.
Mm-hmm. That's what it was. It was New Amsterdam at one point.
It was New Amsterdam, right? And you can see that on the Wall Street building there, the stock exchange. So you know, that's what we're dealing with, is we have different nations. So when they talk about race, they're trying to demoralize us. CRT, DEI, it's meant to demoralize us. We have to realize we are a people. And I'm saying this to all your listeners. If you are an American, that means you are of European descent, you're Christian, you speak English, you're born in this country, you adhere to the American heritage, you're an American, okay? We are good people. We are to be proud, rightfully so, not improperly so, as a nation, and we have rights as a nation. And that means we do not get to be demoralized or destroyed, our culture destroyed, our heroes demeaned, our statues taken down, our history rewritten. That is all crap, because we settled this country, we built this country, and we did a lot of good for a lot of people. And the other peoples in this country have added to the greatness of this country too. And they are as much entitled to their nation, to their people being developed, and this is the word the Catholic Church uses, developed, okay, properly developed, you know, and that means spiritually and materially, having the goods you need to live a good life, which means expanding the economic pie, which means cutting the bottom line maybe of the top 0.1%, so that they can like help other industries grow with the other peoples and help to bring us all together instead of putting us each other's throats so we don't notice what they're doing to us. Because if you look back at Occupy Wall Street, remember that? Remember Occupy mm-hmm. Wall Street? Mm-hmm. Okay, that was over with in 2011, 2012. Okay, it's questionable how that started. But you know what? Right after that was Ferguson. And all the racial stuff just took right off.
A lot of the queer agenda too, yeah.
And the queer agenda, thank you. Yeah, yes, yeah. That all took off. Just and the chart was on Twitter the other day. It's just amazing. It just took off. And so that's a way to keep us distracted and at odds with each other. And it's coming from the top, folks. And they're all different types of people that are there at the top. Now, there is a very real issue. You know, there's a very real issue with the Chinese. The Chinese are serious, and they have got plans to make themselves a great power. And they want to respect and recognize power. And Janet Yellen went over there, and Anthony Blinken went over there, and they look very weak, extremely weak. And so I thought about that, and I said, you know, I mean, they're really, I think they're lightweights. Some people think Janet Yellen's doing the best she can. I mean, there was a Wall Street Journal article back at the beginning of this month, which indicates to me she really misunderstood what free trade was about, which I find that hard to believe, which is basically that all the manufacturing goes overseas, and after a while, all you got is the financial stuff, which isn't really enough to deal with this rising power who really has the power of creation to make stuff. Mm-hmm. So it really showed me how she was deluded. But there's another dynamic here. What is the historical relationship between Jews and Chinese? Well, there actually is a relationship. And so I did a little research on that. There's an article from a few years back. God, what's the name of it? I was looking it up. I can't find the name of it. But it talks about how there's been this interplay, and Jews have settled in China, and they have assimilated. But the Chinese never assimilated into the Jewish culture, which I find that very interesting. How that plays, I'm not sure. But I know.
Weren't there Jews involved, like in Mao? Like one thing was Sidney Rittenberg was a Chinese communist.
he was a Chinese communist.
Didn't he grow up like in Virginia or something? Then he ended up over there in Mao's China.
I don't know. The guys that the Soviet Union sent over to help Mao, he was a Jew.
Yeah.
And I can't think of his name now. He took a Chinese name, but they have a history. But these, I mean, Blinken is just a lightweight. I mean, you look at this guy, he's a lightweight. And so you got to wonder what's going on with the administration here. Do they understand there's a problem? And I am not feeling comfortable with this administration.
Well, it was so, Putin that said the problem with the West, particularly America, is you don't know who's in charge.
Well, you know who gets invited to the state dinners. They're in charge. So that was Jamie Dimon. Of course, you know, Jerome Powell.
So there we go. So it's a form of criminology now. Remember the back in the old day? You'd see who was up on the podium next to Brezhnev, who the premier was, and forget who was in.
Right.
So now in the West, we're supposed to have open government elections and free press, and we're supposed to have an informed citizenry voting and deciding these things. Well, it's obvious that the Congress, this cares little or nothing for the American people with the bills they've been signing and the money they've been spending on foreign wars, provoking wars. There's absolutely no representation of the American people, much less the white rural Americans. In the past, it's always been the white rural Americans who fight the wars that New York and Washington fight, you know, start, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Then America gets blamed for like Vietnam, or gets blamed for like Israel, or gets blamed for what's going on in Ukraine. Well, because the government's doing it. The Americans don't support it.
Well,
But the Americans don't even have a free press. They don't have an institution to inform them. We know how control the this free First Amendment stuff is a joke, because the press is just a product of corporate interest, various ethnic and corporate interests. It's like
The powerful private interests, the economic interests are there.
yes.
So who else showed up at the state dinner? Okay, so you had Tim Cook, okay, Apple, huge. I mean, the huge business relationships with China, but they've lost 24% of their revenue. Okay, you've seen a lot of American companies are pulling out of China, and so let's see who else showed up at that. Who showed up at that dinner? I'm just kind of stream of consciousness here, but let's see. At the dinner, was Bezos was there? Okay, I'm looking at the list here. You had these. So this is American industry now. It's information industry and it's services industry. That's our strength. It used to be, GE and GM, General Motors, General Electric, and the manufacturing. But now it's these guys. And the information systems, the Microsofts of the world, the Apples of the world, they perform a lot of functions. They can spy on people, they can corrupt societies, they can create markets, they can do a lot of things. Well, the Chinese got wise to that. And 10 plus years ago, they limited those apps. They got rid of YouTube. They deplatformed YouTube in China. So that should make a lot of people feel good who've been deplatformed from YouTube in this country. So the Chinese deplatformed YouTube and Facebook. They said, "You're not going to operate here. We got our own. It's called WeChat." Well, they understand the importance of the information technologies because these things are extensions of U.S. power. The Chinese blunted that 10 to 12 years ago, and they took out a lot of the CIA infrastructure also in the same period of time. So as a result, we don't have a lot of control. We know that they kind of have some issues there with their population and not fully, we know it's declining and they're not fully consumers yet. And all these companies want to get in and become consumers and make these people consumers. Now, all these big American companies, chambers of commerce and so on and so forth, met with Xi personally in San Francisco in November 15th of last year. And then again, at the end of March, I think it was March 26, 27. And so here's the host organization representatives from November: Mark Caspar, Chair, U.S. China Business Council, Chairman, Chief Executive Officer, Thermo Fisher Scientific, Mr. Stephen Carina, President, National Committee, U.S. China Relations, John Thomas, Michael Froman, Susan Clark, Evan Greenberg, Honorable Craig Allen, Tim Cook, of course, Lawrence Fink. Oh, who's he? Oh, yeah,
Yeah.
BlackRock.
Oh,
Yeah,
yeah.
Stephen Schwartzman. Okay. Stanley A. Deal, Hock Tan, Ming Hsieh, Daniel O'Day, Joseph Bay, Darius Adamczyk, Robert Goldstein, Jan Au, of the chair of MasterCard. So you're seeing a lot of business organizations, a lot of financial organizations, a high tech trying to get in there and do business to consumerize, that country. Well, I think what the Chinese are doing, they're buying time. And if your whole policy, your whole purpose is to give these companies the bottom line, that can pose problems down the road. It has to be balanced with traditional ideas of national security, which is you manufacture, you have an ethnic identity, you have a strong national identity, you have strong people, you control what your motion pictures say. I said, "Hey, I got an idea," to a bunch of people the other day. I said, "Why don't we make good, wholesome motion pictures and we ship them out around the world, showing how great all the different peoples of the world are? And we go around the world and we help them build their infrastructure too. What do you think of that?"
Well, yeah, that idea of development economics was abandoned long ago. And that's kind of like also with genuine missionary work and these things. And that was kind of abandoned in the 1960s because of decolonization, the civil rights era, these things, the idea that the West had nothing to offer to the world in terms of, philosophy, outlook, ideology, and became, it didn't help the fact, of course, that again, elite institutions like the CIA or Wall Street were exploiting the world, staging coups, overthrowing governments that might have that nationalist impulse. You know, like, well, more recently was Gaddafi, but you've had other examples like Mossadegh in Iran or Arbenz in Guatemala. And so the West got a bad reputation. Sort of vulture capitalist exploitation.
We got a bad reputation, and I tell you, what I'm seeing a lot of anti-American sentiment, and I mean, they don't like us as a people, and this just breaks my heart, because we're a good people, and our leadership is bad, and we got a lot of corrupt people
Well, you talk
in the
about like
leadership.
China's controlling the internet, YouTube, and these things. Well, that's authoritarian. We're not like that in America. What, are you kidding me? Are you joking? I mean, have you look around what's happened in the past 10 years at YouTube, at Google, at Facebook, and the scandal of Twitter and the FBI and the control of flow of information. I myself was kicked off YouTube years ago just for saying things that certain people didn't like. Is that the spirit of America and free speech? Is that how you contend with with differing opinions? How you contend with debate? Well, evidently, right now there's open talk with all these campus protests, which are being wildly exaggerated, by the way. No violence, just simply people saying things that another group doesn't like to hear. So that becomes a threat. And now there's open talk about, like Ackman and some other how they're talking about we're going to get the names of the protests so they never get a job. What? It's
Yeah,
like,
I know.
they're
I'm
openly
seeing it.
admitting that
Right.
they're going to blacklist people and deny them means of employment and a support if they have a view they don't like. And there's one hour I was watching the thing on Fox News, this guy Charlie Gasparino, one of these finance guys, saying now some of these law firms, a lot of these financial firms are going to like go to schools like Yeshiva University. He says for obvious reasons. So that he's openly talking about open Jewish nepotism, another as if they need more of that, because there are people on these campuses at Columbia, or Texas, that don't like what Israel is doing, and of course the U.S. government's complicit in it, and therefore Americans are complicit in it because AIPAC controls the Congress, because they can give $500,000 to the speaker to arrange the votes. Americans, we Americans, rural white Americans have no representation in our government because it's all corrupted. And it's because the worship of money, primarily. It's mammon. That's our official religion.
No, I mean, yeah, people say it's an official. I don't think it's a religion. I mean, I think it is a very strong dynamic in this society. But Americans, we have always sought the truth. We have always lived in accordance with the truth because it's practical, and we're practical, and we're optimists, and we make things happen, and we collaborate with each other. That was part of the beauty of parts of the liberal system, representative government, electing people, stuff like that's part of beauty. We're going to get along together, okay? And we had this idea, of religion. People had religion. They knew right and wrong. They were dealing with right and wrong every day. And so you also had this common law that helped in that regard. Now, some of it was wiped away. I get that. But, it was still kind of there. And you had to deal with issues on a day-to-day basis where you just simply had to find the truth to deal with your neighbor, because that was the only way you could communicate. Now, that wasn't necessarily the case at the higher levels. And what I'm also saying, too, aside from the fact that Americans, us Americans, we're good people. We're good people. We have good qualities about us. We've done good stuff. But other than that, what I'm also saying is, finance has its place and trade has its place, okay? And industry has its place. And all these things are supposed to work in harmony. And that is part of the truth that we seek as Americans, that harmonious arrangement of these different facets and factors, which, if you believe in the natural law, which I do and everyone else does, you can find and determine with a little bit of help once in a while, but you need people helping with that. We want healthy and good and true, and we want everybody to be happy, and we want everybody to have enough, and we don't want conflict. This is not the American heart. The American heart seeks truth, it's honest, it's optimistic, it works hard. There's an article in Fortune just 2 days ago. Americans work harder. Yeah, we do. Yeah, we work hard. We're collaborative. We are good people. And we have brought forth, in collaboration with God, on this country, on this continent, his goodness. We have done that.
And yeah,
that
we
is
have.
the truth.
Yeah,
and don't let anybody erase that, and don't let anybody tell you that we don't have a nation, and don't let anybody take down the statues. It just breaks my heart. I was in Arlington last month, Arlington National Cemetery. It broke my heart to go over there and see the statue that had come down, the Confederate statue that came down as a means of trying to reconcile. And that's what we do in this country. We can reconcile. But there are powerful interests who are given over to the love of money. And that is the conflict in America, the love of money versus the love of God. That is the conflict.
Well, that's the conflict for it's the city of man versus the city of God, I guess, you know. But we do have an elite that is now saying, at least suggesting, that if you do have views or you get involved in politics, say you go and protest governmental policy, this may be our foreign policy and our relationship to a foreign state, they will deny you, no matter how hardworking you are, the opportunity for employment. And they're openly saying that.
Oh, yeah. No, I know it. And the statistics that are coming out are just shocking, too. Bloomberg had an article out, I don't know, 3 weeks ago, where it said in 2021, and I wasn't sure their methodology, but what the bottom line was, in 2021, 94% of the new hires were not American.
Mm-hmm.
Means they were Latin, or they were Black, or they were something else, but they were not Americans. They were not ethnic Americans. Well, okay, so what are we dealing with here? Well, we're dealing with an elite that is unfair, that is dividing and causing disorder. That's what we're dealing
with. And then you're dealing also with a competency crisis that's been talked about, because along with these goals and timetables and diversity, equity, inclusion, and make minority set asides, is you have the inability, you simply cannot maintain the high standards and have diversity, because there's only so many among this favored group that can meet the standards. So you lower the standards, then the society starts to deteriorate and crumble. You don't have the infrastructure maintained. Look at every city that's been diversified.
Unbelievable.
Every city, Jackson, Mississippi, Detroit, Baltimore, you know, they revert to the mean, if you will, because they're not under the proper leadership or tutelage. And that's one of the uncomfortable realities. And maybe you have to swallow your pride and accept this. But the reasons why the country became as prosperous and developed it was because of the effort, the ingenuity, the talent, and intellect of its people, which were by and large ethnic Europeans, whites.
Right, that's correct.
And so, but you can't destroy that population, destroy its cap, basically to make war on the capital stock of the country, maintain.
That's
the,
right.
Expect the country to be just as wealthy, and we've seen as become more diverse, it's become more in debt, the currency is devalued, more inflation, the economy is going down. Look at the state of law, you're a lawyer, look at the courts. As they become more diverse and, dare I say, more Jewish, they become less objective and more corrupt. A good example, I saw a video yesterday, Alan Dershowitz openly advocating the abuse of the civil court system to dispossess his critics, openly calling for it. He should be deprived his law license. He should be disbarred. He should be fired from Harvard. And I dare say he should be brought up on charges for racketeering for suggesting such a thing. This is so un-American. The ADL is so un-American. They don't believe in free speech because they can't contend with free speech despite their claims of higher verbal IQ, because they can't deal with the arguments. So they got to lie, cheat, and steal, work behind the scenes. Not even behind the scenes anymore. They're openly talking about it. I mean, as an American, I am highly offended. Because the one thing America has is we don't have a state religion, but we had general Christianity, which was a glue, important glue, but we have freedom of speech.
And that's a shock absorber. That was a shock absorber.
Exactly. Because if you can't get justice, you can't speak up, and you can't get justice in the courts, what's your resort?
That's pretty obvious, isn't it?
Yes. Yes.
And you know, it's interesting. I'm sorry, go ahead.
And they're setting that situation up, and they're going to go, oh, we're a victim again. Really?
Well, what's in this movie is very interesting, because what this movie, Civil War, presents a multi-ethnic, poorer future for America. But what's very curious is you know, the protagonists are a press team, four members of the press, right? But they go into this town that is neat and orderly, and it's all Americans, meaning white people, right?
Okay.
And they're saying, gee, you know, this is really neat. And one said, boy, I'd forgot this existed. Another one said, you know, now I remember it existed. And it's like, and this was peaceful and orderly. This was the peaceful and orderly part of the whole movie. And then what you had is that you had a lot of Americans throughout the movie. The theme was that the Americans were just dropping out. They were just dropping out. They're not going to participate, which is a troubling theme too.
We see that with military recruitment, don't we? I mean,
I'm sorry.
We see that with military recruitment.
Well, exactly. The military recruitment's down because, like the guy in the Military Times said, he said, why do Americans want to join? They're going to be demonized.
Yeah.
I mean, so you've got a political elite, you know, you got an economic elite that is attacking this base population, which is really a bad idea. And unfortunately, you got the church leadership just kind of standing by. And when I say Catholic Jewish Alliance, I'm talking about the ambitious. Okay. I'm talking about, there are a lot of really good Catholics out there. Okay. But I'm talking about the ambitious that are out there wanting to make a name for themselves, and the powerful, and the one who want to climb up, and they're going to make alliances with Jews, WASP, whoever it is, and they're going to betray their own people, and they're going to advance what the powerful want. And that has really, that's really hurt this country. And, the church has to get back to the law of nations. This is the way to go, to say we got peoples that need to be developed, protected. They have to have a good culture. They got to have enough, you know, supplies, food, resources, jobs, meaningful existence. We have to protect them so there's no fighting. We got to make sure there's peace in society. And, you know, we have to work together. And that is what is needed. That's what the law of nations requires. That is something that the church needs to get back to. That is something that everybody needs to get back to. It's a natural law. It's written in our hearts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but everything's at war with it. Well, nature and natural law. I mean, that's
yeah, you know, and another thing too, you know, a lot of people, you know, I'm going to just say it's okay to be white. It's good to be white. Okay.
It's okay. That's AD also.
It's
that was
good
a
to
race,
be white.
AD also, that was a racist term.
Well, yeah, I guess I'm going
to
make the
okay
list.
To be white. It's okay to be white.
It's great to be white. Okay. It's good to be white. Okay.
Yeah.
Don't be ashamed of it. Don't be afraid of it. You want to marry somebody of your same nation? Okay. You want to marry somebody who's American? That's fine. That's okay.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, look, look.
Well, there's the thing. There was a Mark Lamont Hill show on MSNBC. Yeah, he was interviewing Chris Rufo from the Manhattan Institute. And he challenged Chris Rufo, says, what is it about white? What do you white people have? I mean, blacks, we have our culture, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I've seen your culture. Let's talk about that. And then nevertheless, he goes, what do y'all got? And I was like, what an insulting question. And Chris Rufo was so afraid of standing up for being white, he couldn't come back with anything. I would have said, I don't know. What about the language we're speaking? What about the studio you're in?
Yeah, that's
what about
right.
Polyphonic music? What about mathematics and philosophy, English literature? What about music, Beethoven, Bach, you know, anywhere from Bach, Beethoven to the Beatles? I mean, I'm like thinking, what are you, you're sitting there living, you're in a studio built with technology all developed by Europeans from European stock, and you're asking me if there's anything to defend culture? I was like, I mean, that's like, but he had internalized his anti-whiteness so much that he can't defend it. I mean, when openly challenged, I would have said, you just take everything for granted? I mean,
Well, people are scared. They're isolated. They don't have anybody standing up. It's probably you and me are probably the only two people who are standing up right now for what's right. And, you know, if you're an American, be proud, okay? And I've told you what I think an American is. When I say American, that's what I mean, okay? That means you're of this ethnic stock. You're the base ethnic stock. You got to be proud. It's okay to want to be with your own kind. It's okay to want to marry your own kind. And be, because we are here because we had a mother and a father, and they had mothers and fathers, and mm-hmm. so on and so forth, all the way back, okay? And this is what you call a nation. Okay, and nations are good. They're part of God's plan. That's in Matthew, what is it? Going forth and make disciples of all nations. What is that? 28, 22, or whatever it is in Matthew.
Well, I think the term comes from birth, right? It's natal. I mean, it's very basic.
Nacios, I think is
Nacios,
what it comes
yeah,
from.
Which is, you know, blood, birth, that sort of thing, yeah.
It comes from birth, but we're also tied to a specific bit of dirt.
Yeah.
We're tied to a bit of dirt with this family that we have and this whole milieu that we grew up in. And I was just looking, I was just curious. It's like, well, what are some characteristics and traits of Americans? So I just looked around. And so there's a lot of stuff on the internet. Like Americans, meaning like people like you and me, believe in exceptionalism. They like freedom, their can-do attitude. They're informal, optimistic, practical, friendly, like popular government. Sure, I mean it's just we can vote people in and out. And that's a simple fix. I mean just take the money out of politics. I mean really take the money out of politics. That's a simple fix. And then what is American culture? Well, we kind of talked about that. There's individuality, there's stewardship, there's integrity. I mean, this is America. Okay, so like we like a little bit of elbow room, one guy said. We're kind of careful, we're informal, we smile a lot and talk easily to strangers. Man, have I seen that all throughout my life. We've asked, oh, how are you? And that's how we talk. When Americans put their hands on their hips, they're usually relaxed. When they fold their arms tightly across their chest, they're angry or very serious or cold.
Well,
That's
here's the
true.
thing. This is what's so incredible is that these things that define America, even our legal system, which was a product of Anglo-Saxon European culture,
Sure.
it's so when you start introducing that system to people who not only they're not from that stock, they hate that stock, they're not going to support that system. We see that in the
No.
current judges. We've seen you ever seen those entertaining videos of like Senator Kennedy asking the judicial appointments basic law questions and they can't answer them and they're all like black and women and they
Yeah.
so
Yeah.
they have and they're these people are ethnic racial Commissars. They're not
Yeah.
judges. They have no regard for the law. They obviously don't know it. That doesn't matter. And we see that. And that's why we're seeing a lot of this lawfare going waged by you look at all the judges. They can usually the ethnic groups. Either they're Jewish or they're colored. And they have no regard. It's like they're waging war and they have no regard for the law anymore. I know the Anglo-Saxon system wasn't perfect, but it worked generally. And there's some regard for it. At least some pretense have to be maintained here. And we're seeing that break down. We also see we talk about what defines an American and well, the standards behave. There was a this was so insulting is at the same time we were told that you can't have a white identity or have any ethnic pride. Your culture, European, American, and these things, and what created this kind of the civil Western civilization, and it's being lambasted, by the 1619 Project or critical race theory, which is there to it's basically it's iconoclasm. It's destroying the heritage of America to replace it. But a couple of years ago, there was a plaque at the or a poster at the African American Museum in Washington, D.C., part of the Smithsonian Institute, because that's all about racial agitation. But they had a thing is they said aspects of assumptions of whiteness or white culture in the United States. One was rugged individualism, family structure, emphasis on scientific method, history, Protestant work ethic. Well, these are the things that make a wealthy, complex society possible. If you don't have these things, your society crumbles and you get what you have in South Africa or the rest of Black Africa or in Jackson, Mississippi or Detroit or Baltimore,
Yeah, that's right.
and so they're making war on the very things that make our civilization possible.
Right.
Same time, you're told you can't defend it on ethnic terms when they're attacking it on ethnic terms.
They're attacking us and saying we're racist because of the color of our skin. And a white person in the United States is known as an American, and a white person in Germany is known as a German. And we are have a unique and distinct identity. And all those things you talked about, I saw that, and I have a copy of that before they disappeared it. And that's the American character. That's the American character. That's right. All of those things built us as an American people and built this country. Okay, so there's other things here. I mean, we shake hands, make eye contact, we open presents and cards. We don't open presents and cards in presence of others. Yeah, there's a whole identity that we have that's very unique. That's just being wiped away. And we have to know we're special and unique. So I want everybody to go and look at the pictures of your parents and go back as far as you can and realize you're a part of a nation. And the only way we can bring peace in this country is to realize we're nations and kick out the 12 million illegals. Now, is that possible? Yes, I think it is possible. I understand that 12 million illegals were ejected from this country from about 1931 to about 1947. It was under three presidents. Well, the country was half the population then. So it is doable. It's doable to kick these people out.
Well, who's going to do my landscaping?
Gee, I don't know.
Who's going to mow my lawn? Who's going to paint my house? Who's going to put the roof on my house? Who's going to do the labor? You might have to pay the native population higher wages,
Might
so
have to pay him.
they can support a family and pay for private school and support parishes and create and maintain the culture, a sustainable culture, and make a better life for everybody. Well, I don't want to cut into my bottom line. The
That
same time,
is that
I'll put up with crime and social.
solidarity. They have the elites. I'm talking about the socioeconomic elites, the billionaires, as you know, have to have solidarity with us.
And they don't
And they
anymore.
don't.
If they ever did, but they don't now. I
They
mean, that's
definitely don't
that's
now.
what introduced slavery in the country, was a few rich planters and Jewish slave traders wanted to exploit ch cheap black labor, and to heck with the native population, the white native population. And then they created this interminable, apparently insoluble racial problem, which then they later exploit for their objectives. I mean, it's something else.
I mean, there, yeah, it is something else, and you know, the people at the top need to be,
And they blame
need to
white
convert it.
rural Americans.
Yeah, they blame
You know, the
white
guys
rural
who are in the
Americans.
Klan, most of them were probably never slaveholders. You know,
The
or they're.
guys in the Klan were farmers and they were middle class. Okay. And when Brown versus Board of Education came down, what was the name of the citizens councils? The citizens councils that formed, hundreds of thousands of people joined these things in a short period of time. They were all middle class and professional Americans. Okay.
But
Th this was
apparently that's not democracy, though.
well
A court ruling is democracy based on no
th
law, by the way.
this is your core, that's right. This is your core population. This is your core population. I read the book. I read the book by one of the prosecutors, by one of the defense, one of the lawyers who defended. There were actually five cases that went up to Brown versus Board of Education. Actually, five, and I mean, two of the lawyers of the five were Jews. Okay, defending segregation. Okay, and the other three were Americans. And so, this guy said, "Look, in Kansas, I mean, the blacks were happy." We didn't want to integrate the schools because they
Pittman
had
said,
their own society.
yes.
So this is what this is what this and you know that I know that. So this is what you know we talk about.
This is the cult of integration. It wasn't done to make people better, it was done to make everyone weaker.
Yeah, it was made done to make people weaker, and we have to get back to the idea that there are nations, and the proper function of the state is to create order and
I mean,
not disorder.
the Catholic Church was taken in by this sort of sentimental moral appeal. That's why it was Bernard Law, I think, was in Louisiana at the time. The cardinal, he threatened to excommunicate all Catholics who opposed desegregation. I don't think he ever threatened to excommunicate advocates for abortion, Catholics advocates for
He
abortion.
probably didn't. John Lafarge had the ability to be really honest. He was a blue blood. He was a grand. He was descended from Ben Franklin, and he wrote John Courtney Murray, and it's in my book. He said, you know, he said, look, and I'm paraphrasing. He said, look, I mean, the bishops are bought off. They're bought off with money. It's very plain. I mean, I'm sorry to say that. It grieves me to say that, but at some point, folks, we got to get back to our mission. Okay.
American bishops are too fat, rich, and happy.
Yep, that too.
They're brick and mortar men, you know. And that's the compromise that American Catholics made. You live a good life, you can have your little operation, and you can have your schools and all this stuff, but don't make trouble. And most people are willing to sign on to that. You know,
Most people do sign on to
they
that,
want to
and
they have a place at the table. That's what's important.
they have a place at the table, but you know, leadership recognizes the bigger picture, and the rich and the entrepreneurs and the innovators, and the innovators and the entrepreneurs is what gave America a real edge for a long time, and to a degree, it still is the case, and so did liberalism. Liberalism was this ideology that was pushed out, and with World War II, it became a part of, really a part of American ethnic
That's right.
identity almost, you know, to push it out. That's what we're fighting for.
The four
And
freedoms, yeah.
yeah, the four freedoms, exactly. And so, but this is it. And so, but this has to all be controlled. And you know, I'm here to tell you, I'm not telling you that China is the way it should be. For some reason, the elites really like the way China is.
Yeah, David Rockefeller loved it. Yeah, even though he loved Mao.
Yeah, he loved Mao. I mean, these guys, and Schwab loves Xi, you know? And it's like, I mean, these guys are tyrannical, okay? They're tyrannical, and there's, you know, they're good copycats, and they're smart people, okay? They're smart people, but I really don't think a world order where they exert a lot of influence is necessarily a good thing.
No,
I think the world order has to be reformed, and I think there are reforms going on. There's a meeting at the UN in September to talk about that, and where that's going to go, I don't know. But there needs to be some reforms.
Something in the East, particularly East Asians, they're very good at imitative absorption, but not good at like creativity or innovation. They have to piggyback on somebody, then they copy it well.
And that's why they stole a lot of our stuff. Yeah. They've done a lot of bad stuff. The Chinese have done a lot of bad stuff. They're claiming the South China Sea.
Yeah.
The United Nations Convention on the Law of Seas told them, you don't have a right to that sea. That belongs to humanity. And they said, well, we don't recognize it. I mean, this is a violation of a fundamental norm of international law, a fundamental norm of the law of nations, even as Catholics conceive of the law of nations. That's what they're doing.
But we needed China to produce cheap stuff for Walmart so you could get quarterly profits up, and it didn't matter if you deindustrialized and threw millions of Americans out of work in the process, because Americans wanted too much, were used to higher salaries, so higher pay. And so we can make a quick buck by exploiting the cheap labor of Asia. And that's that financialization, that quick calculation. Yeah. It's like there's other ways you evaluate your well-being and do. I mean, obviously, it doesn't just boil down to money, dollars, and cents. There's other things to evaluate. One thing is, but this just goes, these people didn't see themselves as being part of America. Now, it's funny because American corporations, they profited off the American system. It's ultimately dependent on the Constitution, the laws that the American people provided for them.
Yeah.
Just the idea of the corporate charter is a benefit that the American people give to these corporations, all types of benefits of limited liability. All that's a conferred, which should confer some obligation on their part. That's the way the law should read, at least. There should be some obligation with that corporate charter. It allows you to operate at a scale which enables you to amass all that wealth. And then you can turn around and manipulate and impose ESG like Larry Fink does, like environmental social governance. Eventually, they seem as a superseding governance versus government. But good example, I read World War II, how that changed the U.S. economy. I think in the course of the war, American corporations were capitalized with some like $40 billion of taxpayers' dollars. America wins the war and it's the only economy left standing, and they're in a position to amass even more wealth. Mm-hmm. American corporations, they dominate the planet for the next 25 years. Mm-hmm. Only with the recovery of Europe, the curve of Europe and Japan results in the dollar crisis of the late 60s and the collapse of the Bretton Woods system. But nevertheless, the fact that these companies were capitalized with the tax dollars meant they should have some obligation to their host country, their home country. They should see it as a home country. But they had no sense of loyalty to that America, which enabled them, the 400,000 Americans that died overseas, which basically allowed them to increase their profit margin. They acknowledged no responsibility or obligation to the American people. You know,
I think that is what breaks a lot of people's hearts, because this country has given them so much.
They didn't get wealth through a libertarian system. They were subsidized heavily.
Yes, that's right. And
look at Google. Right. Google piggybacks on this whole internet, which is created by the U.S. taxpayer.
That's right.
It's the Defense Department. They just piggybacked on it. So basically, we're all stakeholders in this thing. We're all paid for it.
Ray Dalio wrote a book about, the rise and decline of great empires. He says the United States is like 60 to 80% along the process and China's rising. Mm-hmm. This was about 2 years ago. He said that there would be a war, 35% chance of a war in about 5 years or so. And other people are saying that there's going to be a war in 2027. So what Dalio said, he said, all throughout history, the innovators, the businessmen, have always worked with the political powers to maximize their position. Well, hey, that's right, Ray. And that is true, but they have to have a loyalty to their people. And that's one thing I'm a little critical in his book. He doesn't seem to assign responsibility to this private class of people. And I think we have to recognize that there's a private class of people that have affected this country, but also countries around the world. And there needs to be some way to regulate that. And it takes the proper political will to do it. I mean, it takes the will to do it. I mean, you know, there's a lot of statutes out there. There's a lot of things we can do. There are a lot of tools in the toolbox that we can do to turn this economy around, turn around quickly, to punish the people who are not loyal under the law, and at the same time, you know, really rejuvenate this country. There's a lot of ways to do it, financially, economically. You know, there's laws called the National Defense Act. We can get industries going right now if the president signs off on it. And then, you know, the whole idea with this giant deficit. It is troubling. You know, this can be dealt with. There are different fiscal tools that they got. There are different monetary tools that they got that they can implement, but it takes the will, and some people are going to hurt more than others. Okay. But once again, these things are fixable. It just takes the political will.
Yeah. Well, and like in 2008, they could have.
You have to have a vision.
Yeah. In 2008, they could have paid off everyone's mortgage for the fraction of the bailouts that ensued. But that would have, well, that would have punished the people who created the crash.
Yeah. Right.
In America, we don't do that.
Right. I mean, so, you know, there's a lot of people that depend on these big financial firms and on the treasuries, and a lot of private individuals own treasuries.
Oh, yeah.
But
a lot of unwinding to do. A lot of unwinding.
But it's doable. I mean, I'm and it's too complicated, and we don't have time for it all right now. But I mean, there's ways they can do this, and it's doable. I mean,
well, someone put it.
We're Americans. We make stuff work, buddy.
The can do, yeah. The can do.
We're can do. Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Would you rather have what? Would you rather have 100 million Americans rioting because they're starving, or 1,000, investment bankers going hungry? Yeah, it's like, which would you rather have?
we can put the investment bankers on welfare. We got welfare.
Yeah. Give them a pension. Put them on an island somewhere.
Yeah. Give them their own island. Give them a gated community somewhere. No, there's ways to fix this. It takes the political will. Just don't forget who we are. Don't forget who you are. Don't forget how great this country is, this land.
Well, to turn it around, you have to start, like, stop this anti-white hiring practice. You might have to start hiring boring white men to do a lot of the work. And that goes against the zeitgeist because everyone knows that, you know, it's the white guy, it's the whitey, it's caused all the problems in the world. So,
well, just remember, the white guy is the American.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I can't imagine anybody thinking an American is an existential threat to America. I just can't imagine that.
Yeah. Joe Biden, he celebrates. Remember, he's one that said, I think it was 2017 or 18, he had that speech. And of course, he says that the unrelenting stream of people coming in the country will soon replace the white majority. And there would never be a white majority again in America. And then he says, that's a good thing.
Yeah, I don't know what he's thinking. He's a Catholic, and he doesn't even know his own law of nations.
Yeah. He probably doesn't know who he is anymore. And to his behind him was Alejandro Mayorkas.
Yeah, with Hayas helping to bring people
Hayas,
up here.
Yeah, the chairman of a board member of Hayas is now spearheading our border defense. I wonder why there's no border defense. it's like
you know, one of the things that we have really been demoralized with, and this is all demoralizing. Everything you talked about is demoralizing in many ways, and the social media is being used to demoralize us too, because it's constant negativity.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to find positive stuff, okay? And we have to look around, look at the national parks, look at go down, you know, look at your downtown, look at the local parks where you grew up, take time out, walk around, look at stuff, talk to your neighbors, be positive. Okay. Because remember, they're trying to drag us down with social media, mainstream media, and a lot of other things. They're trying to drag us down. They're trying to demoralize. They're trying to break our will. Okay. Now I'm going to tell you a little bit of something about American history. Read American history too. I've been reading a lot of American history lately. Read American history. Have you ever heard of the Battle of Fort Harrison?
No.
Of course not. You know why you haven't heard of it? Well, forget that. Let me tell you about the Battle of Fort Harrison, okay? One of the most important battles that was ever fought. You know why? Because it was the first time the Americans defeated the British in the War of 1812. And it was fought in what is now Terre Haute, Indiana, in September of 1812. And there was an American garrison at the fort that William Henry Harrison had built, I don't know, like 1804. So this is September of 1812. And there's an American garrison, there's 50 guys there. And somebody served bad food, and 35 of them got sick as crap. Okay. And so, I mean, they're really sick as dogs. And there's only like 15 left, right? Well, here come the Indians and the British. There's 600 of them. Okay. 15 guys with rifles in the fort versus 600 Indians. And they held them off for 9 days. And the Indians and the British withdrew. That was the first victory in that war. But look at the odds, 40 to 1. At one point, this is the American spirit. We overcome tough odds, okay? Like Jedediah Smith, read about him, everybody. Okay, so we overcome great odds. And one thing is really funny. There's two things that are funny about this story that I want to tell you. And one thing is, and this is true, by the way, this is all true. So one night, the Indians and the British set fire to the fort, right? So what the Americans do is they sit back and they can see from the fire, they can see the figures of the Indians and the British, and they shoot them. Okay, so that was very effective. The next thing I want to tell you about is the guy who was in charge was an army captain, and he said, "Taylor never surrenders." And he said that at the beginning, and he said it every day, "Taylor never surrenders." Captain Taylor was Captain Zachary
Oh
Taylor,
yeah, president,
and
yeah.
he became a president. He said, "Taylor never surrenders." Read about these guys. Read about this stuff. Read about the event. There was 2 weeks ago. Hang on, let me pull up.
He was vice president under Harrison, right? Who died in 30 days.
Tippecanoe and Tyler. No, that was Tyler. Zachary Taylor led the attack in
It was
Mexico.
Tyler, John Tyler. Okay, John Tyler,
Yeah.
the presidents. Okay.
There was a guy here who invented. Well, okay, that's it. So I guess that's it. I can't open my thing. But we have inventors, we have writers, we have so many wonderful people doing incredible things. And you just every day there's something about our history that's fantastic. April 26, 1607, the English settlers made their first landfall in Virginia. It's called Cape Henry, and they planted across there. And then a few weeks later, they landed at Jamestown. You know, the rest is history. But they put a cross there. They were English Anglicans, I suppose. But you know, that's what they did. They recognized Christ. They recognized God. And but this is what we've done. We've always had the inventors. We've always had this creativity, and that requires working with God, the empirical method, working with God, cooperating creation, and just remember that. Remember who
What
we
was
are.
that story? Daniel Boone was his daughter was kidnapped by Indians, and he went into the interior of Ohio. He was in Pennsylvania. He followed them, trailed them, followed them into Ohio, and got her back. What a great story!
I
And
know it.
kids aren't told that story anymore. I mean, think
Oh,
about what
that's
the
right.
you know this. I think this became the foundation for the for James Fenimore Cooper. You know, the Last of the Mohicans,
I think it was. I
which
think
was.
you are correct.
And who was the first? And let's face it, that is quintessentially that is like the creation of America. I think it starts off with the French and Indian War, 7 Years' War, and he says there. And it what then it came to pass that the French, France and Britain, France and Britain would two of the world's greatest powers would fight for a country neither of them were destined to control.
Yeah, right.
But it was like these are the stories. That's so American. But now they idealize or lionize Indians and make the Americans buffoons, even though the mission was successful.
Yeah,
I mean, what
well,
an incredible feat! You think about that.
yeah,
And
yeah.
he was a Quaker. I think he was no longer a Quaker by the time he went to Ohio. He got his daughter because you can't be a Quaker and do what he did.
Yeah, well,
but it's a
these were
great
tough
story.
people. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, and it's based on truth. I mean, there's something, if you're on Twitter, there's this, God, what's this guy's name? I can't think of it. Let's see. He's got this, he has American history. I read it like every once in a while. And he talks about these tough hombres. you know, that were American Texas Rangers that went after the bad guys.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And he talks about how the Rangers fought the Comanche and defeated them. And it was real. The Rangers learned how the Comanches fought. And then they tracked them and they worked harder and they improved their technology and they had cohesion. They worked together. They collaborated and they beat the Comanches.
Yeah. Watch Lonesome Dove, that Western from the 80s. Remember the television miniseries, Lonesome Dove?
I don't remember that.
Robert
I remember
Duvall.
The title.
Robert Duvall and Ricky Schroeder. Who's the guy who wrote Terms of Endearment? McCordy was his name. It was going to be a motion picture, but it turned out it was too epic, and it was like a 4-part miniseries. But it was just one of these westerns, revival of the western in the 80s. Actually, revived the westerns in the 80s.
Oh wow!
Silverado, and then. With Lonesome Dove was made for TV, but it's about these aging Rangers and, you know, how resourceful and brave they are. It's actually a very good miniseries. You can get on DVD or watch it. I highly recommend it to you.
I'll watch it. I will definitely watch it. There's so much history. There is, you know, these were some tough guys that settled this country, and you had to have your head screwed on right, and you had to collaborate and work with people. And that's what, you know, this is what this guy, Turner talked about. He said the frontier theory that kind of formed our character.
Yeah, Frederick Jackson Turner. Yeah,
Frederick Jackson. Thank you. Yeah, that kind of formed our character, who we were. And I think that's always been with us. I think it always has. You know, that's we're Americans.
Mm-hmm.
We're separate and distinct people with all the rights and entitlements and duties of every other people on this earth, and we are unique and distinct, and we inhabit this land. And we are a certain type of people, and that's what I explain in the article.
Well, how do you justify yourself? Because I'm here.
Yeah.
And I don't need to justify myself to you, you know.
Right.
But, they, you know, 60 years of indoctrination, of guilt tripping and pathologizing, this has its effect with the media. And that's, you know.
It's very subtle, and it's been persistent for all these years. And we didn't really notice it at first.
No.
But it was there. It was always just a drip, 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 drip. And when you look back, I mean, I really enjoy watching some of the 50s Westerns and just some of the shows that we used to watch in the 60s, because it was just so wholesome and funny. And everybody was, you know, in it together. I mean, let's put on movies where we got normal families, okay? Mm-hmm. Let's put on movies where, you know, Americans, and when I say American, I mean white guy, okay? Let's put on movies where we see Americans doing great things. Because we do great, good things. We did do a lot of good, great, good things. And we still are.
Yep. It's just, we just don't have any representation anymore.
Well, we're going to defend ourselves, and we're going to win. Jackson, you know, Taylor never surrenders.
Well, David, I think we covered it.
I think we did.
There we go.
It's always a pleasure, Tim. Thank you so much for your kindness.
Thank you for coming. Oh, sure. Certainly. Thank you for being back on the show. I'll post as soon as I do. I'll send you the link.
Sure.
Good night, then.
Okay. Good night, sir.
Bye-bye.
Lovers will marry our fortunes together. I've got some real estate here in my bag. So we bought packs, cigarettes, and Mrs. Wagner pies, and walked off to look for a said as we boarded a Greyhound in Pittsburgh. Michigan seems like a dream to me now. It took me 4 days to hitchhike from Saginaw. I've come to look for a with the faces. She said the man in the gabardine suit was a spy. I said, be careful, his bow tie's really a camera. Toss me a cigarette, I think there's one in my raincoat. We smoked the last one an hour ago. So I looked at the scenery. She read her magazine, and the moon rose over an open field. Kathy, I'm lost, I said, though I knew she was sleeping. I'm empty and aching, and I don't know why. Counting the cards on the New Jersey turnpike, they've all come.